Ahoy and welcome aboard, shipmates. It's great to have you here. I'm Malcolm Torres, your host of the Sea Stories and Science Fiction Podcast, and I've got a great story for you today. This is a tale of drunkenness, violent mutiny, and a grand disaster among the crew who are celebrating the 4th of July aboard a sailing ship at sea. All right, I know why you're here. It's for the sea story. So let's just have a quick word from our sponsor and we'll get right into it. Today's story is Mutiny Aboard the Allspice Privateer. And this story is from Ocean Adventures. It was a book published in the 1850s by John Sleeper. The Allspice Privateer. It was the 4th of July. The ship California of New York was on her homeward-bound passage from Batavia, and on this memorable day was in the latitude of about 17 degrees south, running down the trades, and with a cloud of sail set to catch the passing breeze, she was a gallant sight. Indeed, I have often heard it remarked by persons of undoubted taste that there is no sight more beautiful than a noble ship under full sail, unless, indeed, it be the graceful form and smiling features of a lovely woman. There is probably no more delightful sailing in the world than while running down the southeast trades, in returning from a voyage to India. The wind is usually fixed immovably at one point near the southeast and steering to the northwest, with every rag of canvas set, skysails, studding sails, and both sides, you cross from 15 to 20 degrees of south latitude, sailing a distance of some 10 or 1200 miles, where the wind is always steady, blowing a gentle breeze, with no squalls, gales, or waterspouts to excite alarm or give variety to the scene. The sea is as tranquil as the sleep of innocence, although a long swell comes now and then, lazily rolling along after you. It is not unusual in light winds for a vessel to sail along in this way for a fortnight or more without taking in a stitch of canvas or even starting a rope during the whole of that time. Sailors, however, complain of the weather in these latitudes as too monotonous. An occasional change of wind or of weather is required to produce excitement, stir in the energies of the crew, and chase away the blues, which are apt to prevail even among seamen during a long continuation of mild and pleasant weather, and more especially during a calm. In those days, grog was considered an important article among the stores of a ship. It was regarded not only as a luxury, which Jack dearly loved, but also as one of the necessaries of life. Every ship had more or less of it on board. It was regularly meted out to the crew, and on extraordinary occasions a double allowance was furnished. Its nature is better understood now. It is pronounced vile stuff, productive of no good but of immense harm, and is banished from all well-regulated ships. It was allowed on board the California in accordance with the customs of the time. On this day, the 4th of July, the California had the American ensign proudly waving at her peak, in honor of the day which gave birth to American independence. During the dog watch, in the edge of the evening, the crew, mostly Englishmen and Irishmen, voted unanimously that Tom Smith, otherwise known as Teague O'Connor, should go aft and ask the captain for an extra pot of grog, in which the crew might drink health and long life to America. Teague acquitted himself of his commission to the charm, and the captain, with a smile, ordered the steward to hand over the extra allowances. All was now mirth and jollity on board. Several patriotic songs were sung, and the battles of the Constitution were rattled off in a style and with an emphasis and power which would have elicited a stare of wonder from a worshipper of Grissy or Jenny Lind. All at once Tom Smith bawled out, "Where is Jim McDermott?" and then it was seen that Jim was suddenly disappeared from among his shipmates, without having tasted the grog or joined in their revels. "What's in the wind now?" said Tom Delaney. "Jim, hello there below. Come, old fellow, rouse out. Show your ugly phiz among us." But no answer was given to the summons, and no Jim made his appearance from the forecastle. The crew now began to be alarmed, and the forecastle was searched, but Jim was not to be found. At length the steward said he had seen Jim going down into the half-deck about half an hour before, and whether he had come up or not was more than he could tell. Down into the half-deck went two or three of the jovial crew, and sure enough there was Jim McDermott, snugly stowed away on a coil of rigging between two water casks, and looking as down in the mouth as a landsman in a hurricane. "Hello, Jim, what are you doing there?" exclaimed Tom. "Come on, man, lend us a hand on the forecastle to drink success to American independence. The captain has given us an extra pot of grog. Long life to him. Come, old fellow," added Tom, smacking his lips. "Rouse up. We shall have a capital time. I wish the 4th of July would come every month in the year." "Every month? God forbid," replied Jim with a faltering voice and a haggard look. "The 4th of July puts me in mind of scenes which I should well like to forget, but which are stamped on my memory in characters of living fire. The 4th of July, a day which fills the hearts of so many with gladness, is to me a day of sorrow and of mourning. No, boys, drink your grog and sing your songs and crack your jokes and skylark as much as you please, but don't expect me to join in. I don't feel like it and would much rather be by myself." His shipmates saw that Jim was serious, and with a delicacy which would have done credit to persons who boast of more refinement than is supposed to fall to the lot of a son of the ocean, they abstained from cracking any jokes at Jim's expense. But their curiosity was roused. They saw that something uncommon was the matter with their old shipmate, that the remembrance of some sad event or mishap in former years had cast a cloud over his spirits, and they determined to lose no time in getting to the bottom of his secret. Jim saw that there was no way of evading the inquiries of his shipmates, and he resigned himself to his fate with a degree of fortitude which would have done honor to a martyr. He reluctantly left his snug and solitary berth in the half-deck, and in a few minutes was seated on the deck of the forecastle, with his back supported by the bowsprit bits. He rejected with a look of disgust the cup of grog which was handed to him by Tom Smith, alias Teague O'Connor, to assist in raising his spirits, and after shaking his head two or three more times, and making some wry faces, which would have frightened away a sea serpent himself or Davy Jones if that respectable old gentleman had been coming alongside, Jim commenced in a lackadaisical tone his narrative as follows. "Well, boys, do you see, it's a number of years ago, during the war with Great Britain, I shipped on board the Allspice Privateer, a clipper hermaphrodite brig of 4 guns and 60 men, belonging to New York, and sailed on a cruise after some John Bull ships. And by the way, shipmates, I must say that I think this privateering is a queer kind of business. I have thought a good deal about it, and it does not exactly chime in with my ideas of justice. It is too much akin to piracy."
"Well, never mind that," exclaimed Bill Hodges, rather tartly. "I suppose that has nothing to do with your story."
"No," resumed Jim, "but I suppose there is no harm in saying what one thinks. Well, we had a curious setup of chaps on board the Allspice as ever you did see. The captain's name was Peter Thunderbolt, and he was a quarrelsome, ill-natured bully of a fellow, always drinking and swearing and cutting up his shines among the officers and men. The first lieutenant's name was Harry Hardcastle. He was a short, thick-set, pursy sort of fellow, always bustling about and in everybody's mess, of a quick temper, of an independent spirit, and brave as a lion, for he did not care for anything in the shape of man or beast. He could drink as well as the captain, aye,
and swear a pretty good stick, too. Of course, the captain and he did not set horses together very well. They often quarreled over their cups, and I sometimes thought they would fight it out on the spot. As to the other officers and prize masters, they were a jolly set and used to amuse themselves with singing songs, playing cards, counting their prize money in advance, and laying plans for spending it, for they expected to make their fortunes during the cruise. They could also toss off their can of grog without flinching. Indeed, I never witnessed such disgusting profanity and drunkenness at sea or ashore before or since. I often thought some dreadful disaster would happen. Our crew was made up of all kinds of beings that ever went to sea. Some were soldiers, some were mechanics, some were lumpers, some were merchants, some were broken-down lawyers and doctors, some were farmers, and some were sailors. The sailors were principally Englishmen, Irishmen, Danes, and Swedes. They were a disorderly set of fellows, and used to grumble a good deal at the tyrannical conduct of the bully who had command of the brig. And he, in his turn, would quarrel with the officers and all hands almost every day, and such scenes of quarreling, fighting, singing, skylarking, drinking, swearing, and carousing as there were on board the Allspice have seldom been witnessed, even on board a pirate. All was disorder and confusion in that vessel as long as her timbers hung together. One day, a few degrees to the eastward of Bermuda, we fell in with the English West Indiamen, which, deeply laden, had gotten separated from the convoy a few days before, and after lodging a few shots in her sides, she struck. Her captain, however, if he had known what kind of enemy he had to contend with, might easily have beaten us off. The poor fellow was owner of the ship, too, and had his wife on board, a very pretty woman, and perhaps that was the reason why he did not fight. A fighting ship should never have women on board. Guns and women should never go together, and I wonder that Uncle Sam allows the captains of his ships to take their wives and others of their female relations with them under any pretense. This practice will breed some trouble one of these days, mark my words. Well, the poor fellow begged hard that our skipper would let him go. He had a cargo of sugar and rum, which be of no use to us, and the vessel was such a dull sailor that it was folly to think of sending her in. The skipper's wife, too, cried like a child, and tried hard to soften Captain Thunderbolt's heart, but she might as well have tried to teach pity to a shark when his jaws were about closing on his prey. He ordered some of the traps and trinkets to be taken out, and then, with a malignant grin, told Mr. Hardcastle to set her on fire. I thought at the time that it could not be very wrong to let the poor Englishman go on his way rejoicing, although he was a citizen of a country at war with our own. It was about sunset when we set fire to the ship, which was soon in a sheet of flame, and I shall never forget the distress of the owner and the agony of his wife as they fixed their eyes on the burning bark and beheld the destruction, the wanton destruction of all their hopes. They not only lamented the loss of their vessel, but found themselves at the mercy of a lawless set of privateersmen, who, it would seem, by the confusion and noise and profanity which reigned on board, would not be over scrupulous respecting the rights of man or women either, especially if the man or woman belonged to the enemy. We cruised about in these latitudes for a few weeks and captured three other vessels, two of which, after taking out the crew, we burnt, on the principle that it was our duty to distress our enemy all in our power, the other being a fast-sailing craft with a cargo of coffee and cochineal on board from La Gruyere. We then steered off to the southward, intending to run down to the West India Islands and pick up what we could get, and return to the United States. But the cruise of the Allspice was brought up with a round turn in a way that few of us expected. On the 4th of July, 1814, we were about 200 miles east of Barbados, with a light wind from the eastward and a smooth sea. I shall never forget the day. The occasion was a glorious one, the independence of America, and we were resolved to celebrate it in style. Early in the morning, we hoisted all the bunting we could muster and fired a salute, and a double allowance of grog was served out to all hands, that we might show our patriotism by drinking success to America and freedom, as if a man's patriotism was to be measured by the quantity of grog which he could carry under his jacket. What with patriotism and brandy, the crew and officers got pretty far over the bay. They felt happy and ready for a fight, and if we could have fallen in with one of John Bull's ships of double our size, I verily believe we should have sunk her or carried her by boarding without much ceremony. But no such luck was ours. Not a sail was in sight, and for want of a regular enemy, d'ye see, shipmates, we fell to fightin' among ourselves. Captain Thunderbolt and the lieutenants had dined together, and in the afternoon came on deck with their skins well filled with old Madeira and sherry. Captain Thunderbolt, who felt ripe for mischief and hated to see the crew look so happy, ordered every man to his station for the purpose of exercising the guns. The men, who expected a holiday, and who by this time felt pretty independent, grumbled at this and showed no disposition to obey orders. Mr. Hardcastle, whose little eyes began to twinkle, a sure sign that he was ready to oppose anything from a quarter in the shape of the enemy or an argument, took sides with the men and told the captain that it was sheer nonsense to go to work exercising the guns at such a time as this. And in saying so, he said no more than the truth. The captain bristled up at this and called the lieutenant an insolent scoundrel and a mutineer. The lieutenant retorted by knocking the captain down. The rest of the officers stepped forward to have a finger in the mess and, with a portion of the crew, took different sides. And as beautiful a row was got up on board the Allspice on that memorable day as the most tough-going Paddy would desire to see on St. Patrick's Day in the evening. But Captain Thunderbolt's party was far the weakest, and Mr. Hardcastle had the popular side, and the question relating to the rights of sailors caused the greatest part of the ship company to join the lieutenant. The consequence was that after a rough-and-tumble contest of some 8 or 10 minutes, the captain and his party were completely routed. Thunderbolt himself had his head broken. The sword which he drew in this conflict was shattered by a blow from a capstan bar, and as he scorned to give it, he was soon secured and pinioned, and required to promise better manners under pain of being put in irons, and was suspended by Mr. Hardcastle in command of the Allspice. The old fellow stormed dreadfully on hearing these terms proposed to him, used the most violent language, and uttered the most diabolical threats. Indeed, what with the intoxicating liquor which he had drunk, and the rage caused by opposition to his tyrannical orders, and the excitement of the fight, he had become a complete madman, and thundered forth, amid the most horrible oaths, that, if he were not released immediately, he would seize the first opportunity to apply a match to the magazine, and blow the ship's company sky high. His looks and language terrified some of the officers who were aware of his diabolical temper and had been accustomed to obey his commands without scruple or delay, and they finally, foolishly, compelled Mr. Hardcastle to relieve him from all restraint, believing that it was out of his power to do mischief, and that he would soon recover the use of his reason, which now seemed to be entirely overthrown. Mr. Hardcastle unwillingly complied. But no sooner was Captain Thunderbolt at liberty, no sooner were his hands released, than he snatched a cutlass from the hand of a prize master and aimed a blow at the first lieutenant, which laid open a portion of his skull and stretched him senseless on the deck. He was then attacked by several of his officers, but he got his back against the companionway so that he could be assaulted only in front and defended himself with desperation. He had desperate men to contend with, however, and soon received several severe wounds. He saw that the fortune of war was against him, and that the mutineers would triumph, especially as none of the crew, notwithstanding his loud cries for help and his terrible menaces, came to his assistance. I never shall forget the wild glare of his eyes, the dark scowl and grin which his bloody features exhibited, when, tossing his cutlass into the sea, he seized a boarding pistol, which was at hand, and shouting at the top of his voice, "I'll be revenged on you, ye rascals. Dearly shall you pay for your mutinous conduct." He rushed down into the cabin. "Follow him," sung out Mr. Wallace, Our second lieutenant, for Hardcastle, lay on the deck, groaning and writhing in pain. He'll do himself some mischief. Take away his pistols and put him in irons till he recovers his senses.
Never!
Burst forth in an unearthly yell from below. You shall never put me in irons. Villains, scoundrels, prepare to meet your doom, which is death, death, death! Fear seemed for an instant to play palsy the minds of all on board at these appalling words. We felt that something dreadful was going to happen. But what no one could conjecture. We, however, were not long in suspense.
"Seize him! Tie him! Knock him down! Shoot him!" exclaimed half a dozen voices, and down in the cabin rushed a body of men, armed with cutlasses and pistols for the purpose of cutting or shooting down Captain Thunderbolt.
But he had got the start of them. I was standing on the larboard bulwark at the time, with my hand on the main swifter, wondering what would happen next, when I heard a clash of arms below. The next moment, the stifled report of a pistol met my ears. It was quickly followed by a sound as loud and deafening as if the archangel had blown the last trumpet to summon the living and the dead to judgment. The furious maniac had set fire to the powder magazine, and the privateer was blown to atoms. I was stunned by the horrid explosion, but only for a moment. When I came to my senses, I found myself in the water. Self-preservation made me seize a plank, which I found floating nearby, and then I looked round on the horrors of the sea. These I shall not attempt to describe. Indeed, I could not if I would, for it is impossible for any language to convey the correct idea of the destruction which was the work of that moment. Even now, to think of it unmans me. The Allspice, as I said before, was completely blown to atoms, and a shower of timbers, planks, spars, and men, some horribly mutilated, and all lifeless, fell around me. There were no screams of agony, no shrieks of terror. The work of death had been done, and all was still. The awful silence which succeeded that dreadful explosion was more terrible than the moans and groans of thousands of human beings. The vast column of smoke which seemed to reach the clouds was soon wafted away by the wind, and the sea, for the space, as it appeared to me, of nearly half a mile, was covered with the fragments of the wreck and with the dead and the dying. As soon as I could realize my situation, I tried to ascertain if any besides myself of the whole ship's company had been saved, or if I was the only one, by the merciful God, had been snatched from the very jaws, as it were, of death. I looked around, and I saw a few of my poor, mutilated shipmates struggle convulsively on the surface of the water and then sink beneath the waves to rise no more. A few minutes passed away, and of all that ship's company, but a few short minutes before, in the full enjoyment of health, the votaries of mirth and glee, only three remained alive. The rest were all summoned in a moment, without preparation, without time to say one prayer, to the judgment seat of God. The boatswain of the Allspice, whose name was Ben Bunting, was thrown into the water at a short distance from me and escaped unhurt, although his faculties were so confused by the explosion and the liquor which he had freely drunk that it was some time before he knew what he was about. Another man, also called Bill Sanderson, who was in the top foremast crosstrees when the brig blew up, was saved, but, poor fellow, his leg was broken, and he was sadly bruised besides. The boatswain and I went to work, as soon as we became fully aware of our desolate situation, to prepare a raft from some floating portions of the wreck, which we soon accomplished. We knew there was no time to be lost, unless we wished to share the fate of our shipmates. We bound our raft together by pieces of rope, which we found attached to the floating spars, and all three of us took possession of it when finished. We also rigged a kind of mast, and prepared a piece of canvas to answer the purpose of a sail. Provisions we had none, and night coming on, we thought it best to put off before the wind and endeavor to reach some of the windward islands, if possible, or fall in with some vessel in their vicinity. This was our only hope. By means of a piece of board, we managed indifferently well to steer the raft, and going through the water in our sort of catamaran at the rate of 2 or 3 knots,
we soon lost sight of the fragment of the wreck of the Allspice. I felt anxious and unhappy, I must confess, but the boatswain kept a stiff upper lip. He was one of those men who never give up the ship as long as there is a shot in the locker, and it was pleasant to see him at such a time when our lives depended on prudence and courage, steering our slender raft as calm as the horse latitudes and as cool as an iceberg off the coast of Spitsbergen. But poor Bill Sanderson was in sad condition. His leg was dreadfully swollen and pained him much. Indeed, all his fortitude seemed to forsake him. He laid on the platform of the raft, groaning bitterly and calling unconsciously to his wife and children far away. But his sorrows were soon ended. He foolishly put his leg in the water alongside, declaring that there was a refreshing coolness in it which brought comfort to his soul. A rascally shark had followed the raft. These scoundrels are always at hand when you meet with a shipwreck or any other serious disaster, and like some of their brethren whom I have seen on land, they are always ready to take advantage of a poor sailor in distress. The monster made a grab at Bill's leg before anyone was aware that he was within hail. The first notice we had was a terrific scream from Bill. As soon as the monster's jaws closed on his trap stick, and if Ben Bunting had not seized him by the collar and held on, the shark would have made a meal of Bill without ceremony. As it was, we determined that if he got Bill, he should work for it. Both of us clinched our shipmate and tugged hard to free him from the jaws of the devouring monster. But the shark would not let go, and a furious struggle took place, Bill all the while shrieking like a madman. At length, we found that the shark, in his own element, was altogether too strong for us. He had found a dainty morsel, and he determined to eat it, and we were reluctantly compelled to let poor Bill go, or go with him, and became the prey of some of the shark's relations or friends. We decided on the former. For though our condition was bad enough on the raft, we feared it would not be better in the salt water. We reluctantly quitted our hold on our wretched shipmate, and with a cry of agony and despair which seemed even now to be ringing in my ears, Bill Sanderson was drawn by the ruthless sea monster beneath the waves. All that night we pursued our course to the westward, and the next day and the following day, the sun poured its fiercest rays upon us, and our sufferings from want of water I shall not attempt to relate. Shipmates, you may never experience the sufferings which fell on my lot on that raft. On the fourth day, after the destruction of the Allspice, I became insane at times, and I verily believed should have jumped overboard had I not been restrained by Ben Bunting. The land of Barbados at length appeared in sight, the announcement of which by Ben, who by this time was pretty far gone too, restored me somewhat to my senses. We ran the raft upon the shore, heedless of the surf which broke high on the beach, and had it not been for the negroes belonging to the plantation on which we were thrown, we must have been drowned at last. We were, however, by the will of Providence, reserved for other purposes. The manager of the plantation treated us with kindness and listened to our tale with interest and pity. He furnished us with food, supplied us with clothing, and after we had recruited our health and spirits, he procured a passage for us to St. Bartholomew's, a neutral port, whence we found no difficulty in getting to the United States. But since that time, continued Jim, the 4th of July never comes along without bringing with it the sad remembrance of the terrible event which I have just related. And when I see the cup of grog pass round and listen to the sound of mirth and jollity and hear the hearty laugh or the patriotic song, I see before me the mangled corpses of my shipmates and forthwith retire to some snug, secluded place where I can give loose to the agonizing feelings which rack my bosom or seek comfort by praying unto the most merciful God.
Wow, what an amazing tale. Such great storytelling amongst these sailors. The violence of the mutiny, the vividness of the disaster, the explosion, the fire. You could hear it and feel it. and being lost at sea and your shipmate wounded and dying and eaten by a shark. Just, wow, this is the real stuff here. And this story is from Ocean Adventures. It was a book published in the 1850s by a guy named John Sleeper. Excellent, excellent sea story. And I've got many more for you with stories of shipwrecks and storms, old suspicions, ghost stories, disasters at sea, mermaids, pirates, sea dogs, war stories, history, drunken captains, sailors wrongly convicted in foreign ports, sailors who fall overboard and survive wild adventures, widowed women whose husbands never came back from sea, and the tales of what happened to them, comical stories as well. So I'm going to have two stories a week for you here on the Sea Stories and Science Fiction podcast. And all I ask in return, folks, is that you subscribe, post a review, look me up on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Goodreads. I'm on all those platforms. My name is Malcolm Torres. It's all about sea stories and science fiction with me. I'm just a complete nut for these types of stories. I just want to share them with you. I would ask one small favor. If you would go to the iBooks app or Amazon website and look me up, Malcolm Torres. You can see there's some links to these in the notes here. Look me up on there. I've got several short stories and short novels that are free, and several are for sale. I'd appreciate if you would download the free ones and read them and post some reviews. And if you enjoy those, then, you know, by all means, purchase the ebooks or the paperbacks and post some reviews on those. So all of you mariners and sailors and submariners, deckhands aboard cargo ships, salty dogs, you blue noses and shellbacks, you know who you are. You yachters and racers and cruisers, you know who you are. You like a good salty sea story, and you found the right place right here. So I look forward to many, many more stories with you in the future. Smooth sailing. Fair winds and following seas, shipmates.